the colony because there was no more brickwork to be done. The nice, quiet job band finished, so I yank I band go back to Minnesota, and back to Minnesota he went. When a man is engaged in work that he loves, it is no hardship for him to do more work and better work than that for which he is paid. And for this very reason, every man owes it to himself to do his best to find the sort of work he likes best. I have a perfect right to offer this advice to the students of this philosophy, for the reason that I have followed it, myself, without reason to regret having done so. This seems to be an appropriate place to inject a little personal history concerning both the author and the law of success philosophy, the purpose of which is to show that labor performed in a spirit of love for the sake of the labor itself never has been and never will be lost. This entire lesson is devoted to the offering of evidence that it really pays to render more service and better service than one is paid to render. What an empty and useless effort this would be if the author had not, himself, practiced this rule long enough to be able to say just how it works out. For over a quarter of a century, I have been engaged in the labor of love out of which this philosophy has been developed, and I am perfectly sincere when I repeat that which I have stated elsewhere in this course, that I have been amply paid for my labors, but the pleasure I have had as I went along, even if I received nothing more. My labors on this philosophy made it necessary many years ago for me to choose between immediate monetary returns, which I might have enjoyed by directing my efforts along purely commercial lines, and remuneration that comes in later years, and which is represented by both the useful financial standards and other forms of pay, which can be measured only in terms of accumulated knowledge that enables one to enjoy the world about him more kindly. The man who engages in work that he loves best does not always have the support in his choice of his closest friends and relatives. Combating negative suggestions from friends and relatives has required an alarming proportion of my energies during the years that I have been engaged in research work for the purpose of gathering, organizing, classifying, and testing the material which has gone into this course. These personal references are made solely for the purpose of showing the students of this philosophy that seldom, if ever, can one hope to engage in the work one loves best without meeting with obstacles of some nature. Generally, the chief obstacles in the way of one engaging in the sort of work one loves best is that it may not be the work which brings the greatest remuneration at the start. To offset this disadvantage, however, the one who engages in the sort of work he loves is generally rewarded with two very decided benefits. Namely, first, he usually finds in such work the greatest of all rewards, happiness, which is, of course, priceless. And secondly, his actual reward in money, when averaged over a lifetime of effort, is generally much greater for the reason that labor which is performed in a spirit of love is usually greater in quantity and finer in quality than that which is performed solely for money. The most embarrassing, and I might without any intention of disrespect say, the most disastrous opposition to my choice of life work came from my wife. This perhaps will explain why I have made frequent references in many of the lessons of this course to the fact that a man's wife may either make or break him, according to the extent to which she gives or withholds cooperation and encouragement in connection with his chosen work. My wife's idea was that I should accept a salaried position that would ensure a regular monthly income, because I had shown, by a few salaried positions I had held, that I had marketable ability which should command an income from $6,000 to $10,000 a year, without any great effort on my part. In a way, I saw my wife's viewpoint and was in sympathy with it, because we had young growing children coming on who needed clothes and education, and a regular salary, even though it were not large, seemed to be a necessity. Despite this logical argument, however, I chose to override my wife's counsel. Came then to her rescue the combined forces of her family and mine, and collectively they charged me head-on with what amounted to a command to write about face and settle down on a salary basis. Studying other people might be all right for a man who had the time to spend in this unprofitable manner, they reasoned, but for a young married man with a growing family, this seemed hardly the thing to do. But I remained adamant. I had made my choice, and I was determined to stand by it. The opposition did not yield to my viewpoint, but gradually, of course, it melted away. Meanwhile, the knowledge that my choice had worked at least a temporary hardship on my family, combined with the thought that my dearest friends and relatives were not in harmony with me, greatly increased my labors. Fortunately, not all of my friends believed my choice unwise. There were a few friends who not only believed I was following a course that would ultimately bring me out somewhere near the top of the mountain of useful achievement, but in addition to believing in my plans, they actually went out of their way to encourage me not to be whipped by either adversity or the opposition of relatives. Of this small group of faithful ones who gave me encouragement at a time when it was badly needed, perhaps one man should have the fullest credit, and this man is Edwin C. Barnes, a business associate of Thomas A. Edison. Mr. Barnes became interested in my chosen work nearly 20 years ago, and I owe it to him to state here that had it not been his unwavering faith in the soundness of the Law of Success philosophy, I would have yielded to the persuasion of my friends and sought the way of least resistance via the salary route. This would have saved me much grief and an almost endless amount of criticism, but it would have wrecked the hopes of a lifetime, and in the end it would, in all probability, have lost also the finest and most desirable of all things, happiness. For I have been extremely happy in my work, even during the periods when the remuneration it brought me could not be measured by nothing but a mountain of debts which I could not pay for the moment. Perhaps this may explain to some extent why the subject of slavery through debt was so extensively emphasized in Lesson 4 on the habit of saving. We want that lesson to sink in. Edwin Barnes not only believed in the soundness of the Law of Success philosophy, but his own financial success had demonstrated, also had his close business relationship with the greatest inventor on earth, that he had the right to speak with authority on the subject of the laws through which success may be achieved. I began my work of research with the belief that success could be attained by anyone with reasonable intelligence and a real desire to succeed by following certain, then by me unknown, rules of procedure. I wanted to know what these rules were and how they could be applied. Mr. Barnes believed as I did. Moreover, he was in a position to know that the astounding achievements of his business associate, Mr. Edison, came about entirely through the application of some of the principles which later were tested and included as part of this philosophy. From his way of thinking, it seemed that the accumulation of money, enjoying peace of mind and finding happiness, could be brought about by the application of never-varying laws which anyone might master and apply. That was my belief also. That belief has now been transformed into not merely a provable, but a proved reality, as I hope every student of this course will have reason to understand when the course shall have been mastered. Please keep in mind that during all these years of research, I was not only applying the law covered for this lesson, but doing more than paid for, but I was going much further than this by doing work for which I did not, at the time I was doing it, hope ever to receive pay. Thus, out of years of chaos, adversity, and opposition, this philosophy was finally completed and reduced to manuscripts ready for publication. For a time, nothing happened. I was resting on my oars, so to speak, before taking the next step towards placing the philosophy in the hands of people who I had reason to believe would welcome it. God moves in mysterious ways, His wonders to perform. During the earlier years of my experience, I thought these words to be empty and meaningless, but I have since modified my belief considerably. I was invited to deliver an address in Canton, Ohio. My coming had been well advertised, and there was reason to expect that I would have a large audience. To the contrary, conflicting meetings being held by two large groups of businessmen reduced my audience to the lucky number of 13. It has always been my belief that a man should do his best, regardless of how much he receives for his services, or the number of people he may be serving or the class of people served. I went at my subject as though the hall was filled. Somehow there arose in me a sort of feeling of resentment on account of the way the wheel of fate had turned against me, and if I had ever made a convincing speech, I made it that night. Down deep in my heart, however, I thought I had failed. I did not know until the next day that I was making history the night before that was destined to give the Law of Success philosophy its first real impetus. One of the men who sat in my audience as one of the 13 was the late Don R. Mellett, who was then the publisher of the Canton Daily News, brief reference to whom I made in the introductory lesson of this course. After I had finished speaking, I slipped out of the back door and returned to my hotel, not wanting to face any of my 13 victims on the way out. The next day I was invited to Mr. Mellett's office. Inasmuch as it was he who had taken the initiative by inviting me to see him, I left it to him to do most of the talking. He began in something like this fashion. "Would you mind telling me your entire life story, from the days of your early childhood on up to the present?" I told him I would do so if he could stand the burden of listening to so long a narrative. He said he could, but before I began, he cautioned me not to omit the unfavorable side. "What I wish you to do," he said, "is to mix the fat with the lean, and let me take a look at your very soul, not from its most favorable side, but from all sides." For 3 hours I talked while Mellett listened. I omitted nothing. I told him of my struggles, of my mistakes, of my impulses to be dishonest when the tides of Ford swept against me swiftly, and of my better judgment which prevailed in the end, but only after my conscience and I had engaged in prolonged combat. I told him how I conceived the idea of organizing the Law of Success philosophy, how I had gone about gathering the data that had gone into the philosophy, of the tests I had made which resulted in the elimination of some of the data and the retention of other parts of it. After I had finished, Mellett said, "I wish to ask you a very personal question, and I hope you will answer it as frankly as you have told me the remainder of your story. Have you accumulated any money from your efforts? And, if not, do you know why you have not?" "No," I replied. "I have accumulated nothing but experience and knowledge in a few debts, and the reason, while it may not be sound, is easily explained. The truth is that I have been so busy all these years in trying to eliminate some of my own ignorance so I could intelligently gather and organize the data that has gone into the Law of Success philosophy, that I have had neither the opportunity nor the inclination to turn my efforts to making money." The serious look on Don Mellett's face, much to my surprise, softened into a smile as he laid his hand on my shoulder and said, "I knew the answer before you stated it, but I wondered if you knew it. You probably know that you are not the only man who has had to sacrifice immediate monetary remuneration for the sake of gathering knowledge. For in truth your experience has been that of every philosopher from the time of Socrates down to the present." Those words fell as the sound of music upon my ears. I had made one of the most embarrassing admissions of my life. I had laid my soul bare, admitting temporary defeat at almost every crossroad which I had passed in my struggles, and I had capped all this off by admitting that an exponent of the Law of Success was, himself, a temporary failure. How incongruous it seemed. I felt stupid, humiliated, embarrassed as I sat in front of the most searching pair of eyes and the most inquisitive man I had ever met. The absurdity of all came to me like a flash. The philosophy of success created and broadcasted by a man who was obviously a failure. This thought stuck me so forcibly that I expressed it in words. "What?" Mellett explained. "A failure? Surely you know the difference between failure and temporary defeat," he continued. "No man is a failure who creates a single idea, much less an entire philosophy that serves to soften disappointments and minimize the hardships of generations yet unborn." I wondered what was the object of this interview. My first conjecture was that Mellett wanted some facts on which to base an attack in his newspaper on the Law of Success philosophy. Perhaps this thought grew out of some of my previous experiences with newspapermen, a few of whom had been antagonistic towards me. At any rate, I decided at the outset of the interview to give him the facts, without embellishment, come from it what would. Before I left Mellett's office, we had become business partners, with the understanding that he could resign as publisher of the Canton Daily News and take over the management of all my affairs as soon as this could be arranged. Meanwhile, I began writing a series of Sunday-featured daily articles, which were published in the Canton Daily News, based upon the Law of Success philosophy. One of these editorials, the one entitled Failure, which appears in the back of one of the lessons of this course, came to the attention of Judge Elbert Gary, who was at the time the chairman of the board of the United States Steel Company. This resulted in the opening of communication between Mellett and Judge Gary, which in turn led to Judge Gary's offer to purchase the Law of Success course for the use of the employees of the Steel Corporation in the manner described in the introductory lesson. The tides of fortune had begun to turn in my favor. The seeds of service, which I had been sowing over a long period of toilsome years by doing more than paid for, were beginning to germinate at last. Despite the fact that my partner was assassinated before our plans had much more than started, and Judge Gary died before the Law of Success philosophy could be rewritten so it conformed to his requirements, the Love's Labor Lost on that fateful night when I spoke to an audience of 13 in Canton, Ohio, started a chain of events which now move rapidly without thought or effort on my part. It is no abuse of confidence to enumerate here a few of the events which shows that no labor of love is ever performed at a total loss, and that those who render more service and better service than that for which they are paid sooner or later receive pay for much more than they actually do. As this lesson is ready to go to the publisher, some of the following well-known concerns are considering favorably the purchase of the Law of Success course for all their employees, while others have actually arranged for the purchase of the course. Mr. Daniel Willard, president of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad Company, Indian Refining Company, Standard Oil Company, New York Life Insurance Company, the Postal Telegraph Commercial Cable Company, the Pierce Arrow Motor Car Company, the Cadillac Car Company, and some 50 other concerns of a similar size. In addition to this, a newly organized club for boys, similar in nature to the YMCA, has contracted for the use of the Law of Success course as the basis of its educational program, and estimates that it will distribute more than 100,000 courses of the philosophy within the next 2 years. Quite aside from these sources of distribution, the Ralston University Press of Meridian, Connecticut, has contracted to publish and distribute the course to individuals throughout the United States, and perhaps in some foreign countries. How many courses they will distribute cannot be accurately estimated, but when one stops to consider the fact that they have a mailing list of approximately 800,000 people who have faith in anything they offer for sale, it seems very reasonable to suppose that their distribution will place tens of thousands of courses in the hands of men and women who are earnestly searching for the knowledge conveyed by the Law of Success philosophy. Perhaps it is unnecessary, but I wish to explain that my only object in here relating the story of how the Law of Success philosophy has gained the recognition described is to show how the law upon which this lesson is based actually works out in the practical affairs of life. If I could have made this analysis without the use of the personal pronoun, I would have done so. With this background of history concerning the Law of Success philosophy as a whole, and this lesson in particular, you are better prepared to accept as sound the law of which this lesson is based. There are more than a score of sound reasons why you should develop the habit of performing more service and better service than that for which you are paid, despite the fact that a large majority of the people are not rendering such service. There are two reasons, however, for rendering such service which transcend in importance all the others, namely, first, by establishing a reputation as being a person who always renders more service and better service than that for which he is paid, you will benefit by comparison with those around you who do so not render such service, and the contrast will be so noticeable that there will be keen competition for your services, no matter what your life work may be. It would be an insult to your intelligence to offer proof of the soundness of this statement, because it is obviously sound. Whether you are preaching sermons, practicing law, writing books, teaching school, or digging ditches, you will become more valuable, and you will be able to command greater pay the minute you gain recognition as a person who does more than that for which he is paid. Second, by far the most important reason why you should render more service than that for which you are paid is a reason that is basic and fundamental in nature, may be described in this way. Suppose that you wish to develop a strong right arm, and suppose that you tried to do so by tying the arm to your side with a rope, thus taking it out of use and giving it a long rest. Would disuse bring strength, or would it bring atrophy and weakness, resulting finally in your being compelled to have the other arm removed? You know that if you wished a strong right arm, you could develop such an arm only by giving it the hardest sort of use. Take a look at the arm of a blacksmith if you wish to know how an arm may be made strong. Out of resistance comes strength. The strongest oak tree of the forest is not the one that is protected from the storm and hidden from the sun, but it is the one that stands in the open, where it is compelled to struggle for its existence against the wind and rain and the scorching sun. It is through the operation of one of nature's unvarying laws that struggle and resistance develop strength. And the purpose of this lesson is to show you how to harness this law, and so use it that it will aid you in your struggle for success. By performing more service and better service than that for which you are now paid, you not only exercise your service-rendering qualities, and thereby develop skill and ability on an extraordinary sort, but you build reputation that is valuable. If you form the habit of rendering such service, you will become so adept in your work that you can command greater remuneration than those who do not perform such service. You will eventually develop sufficient strength to enable you to remove yourself from any undesirable station in life, and no one can or will desire to stop you. If you are an employee, you can make yourself so valuable through this habit of performing more service than that for which you are paid, that you can practically set your own wages and no sensible employer will try and stop you. If your employer should be so unfortunate as to try to withhold from you the compensation to which you are entitled, this will not long remain as a handicap because other employers will discover this unusual quality and offer you employment. The very fact that most people are rendering as little service as they can possibly get by with serves as an advantage to all who are rendering more services than that for which they are paid, because it enables all who do this to profit by comparison. You can get by if you render as little service as possible, but that is all you will get. And when work is slack and retrenchment sets in, you will be one of the first to be dismissed. For more than 25 years, I have carefully studied men with the object of ascertaining why some achieve noteworthy success, while others with just a much ability do not get ahead. And it seems significant that every person whom I observed applying this principle of rendering more service than that for which he was paid was holding a better position and receiving more pay than those who merely performed sufficient service to get by with. Personally, I never received a promotion in my life that I could not trace directly to recognition that I had gained by rendering more service and better service than that for which I was paid. I am stressing the importance of making this principle a habit as a means of enabling an employee to promote himself to a higher position, with greater pay, for the reason that this course will be studied by thousands of young men and young women who work for others. However, the principle applies to the employer or to the professional man or woman just the same as to the employee. Observance of this principle brings a twofold reward. First, it brings the reward of greater material gain than that enjoyed by those who do not observe it. And second, it brings that reward of happiness and satisfaction, which comes only to those who render such service. If you receive no pay except that which comes in your pay envelope, you are underpaid, no matter how much money that envelope contains. My wife has just returned from the public library with a book for me to read. The book is entitled Observation, Every Man, His Own University, by Russell H. Conwell. By chance, I opened this book at the beginning of the chapter entitled Every Man's University, and as I had read it through, my first impulse was to recommend that you go to the public library and read the entire book. But upon second thought, I will not do this. Instead, I will recommend that you purchase the book and read it. Not once, but 100 times, because it covers the subject of this lesson as though it had been written for that purpose. covers it in a far more impressive manner than I could do it. The following quotation from the chapter entitled Every Man's University will give you an idea of a golden nugget of truth to be found throughout the book. The intellect can be made to look far beyond the range of what men and women ordinarily see, but not all the colleges in the world can alone confer this power. This is the reward of self-culture. Each must acquire it for himself, and perhaps this is why the power of observing deeply and widely is so much often found in those men and those women who have never crossed the thresholds of any college but the University of Hard Knocks. Read that book as a part of this lesson, because it will prepare you to profit by the philosophy and psychology upon which the lesson is built. We will now analyze the law upon which this entire lesson is founded, namely, the law of increasing returns. Let us begin our analysis by showing how nature employs this law on behalf of the tillers of the soil. The farmer carefully prepares the ground, then sows his wheat and waits while the law of increasing returns brings back the seed he has sown, plus a manyfold increase. But for this law of increasing returns, man would perish, because he could not make the soil produce sufficient food for his existence. There would be no advantage to be gained by sowing a field of wheat if the harvest yield did not return more than was sown. With this vital tip from nature, which we may gather from the wheat fields, let us proceed to appropriate this law of increasing return and learn how to apply it to the surface we render to the end, that it may yield returns in excess of and out of proportion to the effort put forth. First of all, let us emphasize the fact that there is no trickery or chicanery connected with this law. Although quite a few seem not to have learned this great truth, judging by the number who spend all of their efforts either trying to get something for nothing or something for less than its true value. It is to no such end that we recommend the use of the law of increasing returns, for no such end is possible within the broad meaning of the word success. Another remarkable and noteworthy feature of the law of increasing returns is the fact that it may be used by those who purchase services with as great returns as it can be used by those who render service, for proof of which we have but to study the effects of Henry Ford's famous $5-a-day minimum wage scale, which he inaugurated some years ago. Those who are familiar with the fact say that Mr. Ford was not playing the part of a philanthropist when he inaugurated this minimum wage scale, but to the contrary, he was merely taking advantage of a sound business principle which has probably yielded greater returns, in both dollars and goodwill, than any other single policy ever inaugurated at the Ford plant. By paying more wages than the average, he received more service and better service than the average. At a single stroke, through the inauguration of that minimum wage policy, Ford attracted the best labor on the market and placed a premium upon the privilege of working in his plant. I have no authentic figures at hand bearing on the subject, but I have sound reason to conjecture that for every $5 Ford spent under his policy, he received at least $7.50 worth of service. I have also sound reason to believe that this policy enabled Ford to reduce the cost of supervision, because employment in his plant became so desirable that no worker would care to run the risk of losing his position by soldiering on the job or rendering poor service. Where other employees were forced to depend upon costly supervision in order to get the service to which they were entitled and for which they were paying, Ford got the same or better service by the less expensive method of placing a premium upon employment in his plant. Marshall Field was probably the leading merchant of his time, and the great Field store in Chicago stands today as a monument to his ability to apply the law of increasing returns. A customer purchased an expensive lace waist at the Field store, but did not wear it. 2 years later, she gave it to her niece as a wedding present. The niece quietly returned the waist to the Field store and exchanged it for other merchandise, despite the fact that it had been out for more than 2 years and was then out of style. Not only did the Field store take back the waste, but, what is most important, it did so without argument. Of course, there was no obligation, moral or legal, on the part of the store to accept the return of the waste at that late date, which makes the transaction all the more significance. The waste was originally priced at $50, and of course it'd be thrown on the bargain counter and sold for whatever it would bring. But the keen student of human nature will understand that the field store not only did not lose anything on the waste, but it actually profited by the transaction to an extent that cannot be measured in mere dollars. The woman who returned the waste knew that she was not entitled to a rebate. Therefore, when the store gave her that to which she was not entitled, the transaction won her as a permanent customer. But the effect of the transaction did not end there. It only began. For this woman spread the news of the fair treatment she had received at the field store, far and near. It was the talk of the woman of her set for many days. And the field store received more advertising from the transaction than it could have purchased in any other way with 10 times the value of the waste. The success of the field store was built largely upon Marshall Field's understanding of the law of increasing returns, which prompted him to adopt, as a part of this business policy, the slogan, "The customer is always right." When you do only that for which you are paid, there is nothing out of the ordinary to attract favorable comment about the transaction. But when you are willing to do more than that for which you are paid, your action attracts the favorable attention of all who are affected by the transaction, and goes another step towards establishing a reputation that will eventually set the law of increasing returns to work in your behalf. For this reputation will create a demand for your services far and wide. Carol Downs went to work for W.C. Durant, the automobile manufacturer, in a minor position. He is now Mr. Durant's right-hand man and the president of one of his automobile distributing companies. He promoted himself into this profitable position solely through the aid of the law of increasing returns, which he put into operation by rendering more service and better service than that for which he was paid. In a recent visit with Mr. Downs, I asked him to tell me how he managed to gain promotion so rapidly. In a few brief sentences, he told me the whole story. "When I first went to work with Mr. Durant," said he, "I noticed that he always remained at the office long after all the others had gone home for the day, and I made it my business to stay there also. No one asked me to stay, but I thought someone should be there to give Mr. Durant any assistance he may need. Often he would look around for someone to bring him a letter file or render some other trivial service, and always he found me ready there to serve him. He got under the habit of calling on me. This is about all there is to the story. He got into the habit of calling on me." Read that sentence again for its full meaning of the richest sort. Why did Mr. Durant get into the habit of calling on Mr. Downs? Because Mr. Downs made it his business to be on hand where he could be seen. He deliberately placed himself in Mr. Durant's way in order that he might render service that would place the law of increasing returns back of him. Was he told to do this? No. Was he paid to do this? Yes, he was paid by the opportunity it offered for him to bring himself to the attention of the man who had it within his power to promote him. We are now approaching the most important part of this lesson, because this is an appropriate place at which to suggest that you have the same opportunity to make use of the law of increasing returns that Mr. Downs had, and you can go about the application of the law in exactly the same way that he did, by being on hand and ready to volunteer your services in the performance of work which others may shirk because they are not paid to do it. Stop. Don't say it. Don't even think it if you have the slightest intention of springing the old time-worn phrase entitled, "But my employer is different." Of course he is different. All men are different in most respects. But they are very much alike in this. They are somewhat selfish. In the fact, they are selfish enough not to want a man such as Carol Downs to cast his lot with their competitor, and this very selfishness may be made to serve you as an asset and not as a liability if you have the good judgment to make yourself so useful that the person to whom you sell your services cannot get along without you. One of the most advantageous promotions I ever received came about through an incident which seemed so insignificant that it appeared to be unimportant. One Saturday afternoon, a lawyer whose office was on the same floor as that of my employer came in and asked if I knew where he could get a stenographer to do some work which he was compelled to finish that day. I told him that all of our stenographers had gone to the ball game, and that I would have gone had he called 5 minutes earlier, but that I would be very glad to stay and do his work, as I could go to ball game any day, and his work had to be done then. I did the work for him, and when he asked how much he owed me, I replied, "Oh, about $1,000, as long as it's for you. And if it were for anyone else, I wouldn't charge anything." He smiled and thanked me. Little did I think, when I made that remark, that he would ever pay me $1,000 for an afternoon's work, but he did. 6 months later, after I had entirely forgotten the incident, he called on me again and asked how much salary I was receiving. When I told him, he informed me that he was ready to pay me that $1,000 which I had so laughingly said I would charge him for the work I had performed for him, and he did pay it by giving me a position at $1,000 a year increase in salary. Unconsciously, I had put the law of increasing returns to work in my behalf that afternoon, by giving up the ball game and rendering a service which was obviously rendered out of a desire to be helpful and not for the sake of any monetary consideration. It was not my duty to give up my Saturday afternoon, but it was my privilege. Furthermore, it was a profitable privilege, because it yielded me $1,000 in cash and a much more responsible position than the one I had formerly occupied. It was Carol Down's duty to be on hand until the usual quitting time, but it was his privilege to remain at his post after the other workers had gone, and that privilege, properly exercised, brought him greater responsibility and a salary that yields him more in a year than he would have made in a lifetime in the position he occupied before he exercised the privilege. I have been thinking for more than 25 years of this privilege of performing more service and better service than for what one is paid, and my thoughts have led me to the conclusion that a single hour devoted each day to rendering service for which we are not paid can be made to yield bigger returns than we received from the entire remainder of the day during which we are merely performing our duty. We are still in the neighborhood of the most important part of this lesson. Therefore, think and assimilate as you pass over these pages. The law of increasing returns is no invention of mine, nor do I lay claim to the discovery of the principle of rendering more service and better service than paid for, as a means of utilizing this law. I merely appropriated them after many years of careful observation of those forces which enter into the attainment of success, just as you will appropriate them after you understand their significance. You might begin this appropriation process now by trying an experiment which may easily open your eyes and place back of your efforts powers that you did not know you possessed. Let me caution you, however, not to attempt this experiment in the same spirit in which a certain woman experimented with the biblical passage which says something to the effect that, "If you have faith the size of a grain of mustard, and say to yonder mountain, 'Be removed to some other place,' it will be removed." This woman lived near a high mountain that she could see from her front door. Therefore, as she retired that night, she commanded the mountain to remove itself to some other place. Next morning she jumped out of bed, rushed to the door and looked out, but lo, the mountain was still there. Then she said, "Just as I had expected, I knew it would be there." I am going to ask you to approach this experiment with full faith that it will mark one of the most important turning points of your entire life. I am going to ask you to make the object of this experiment the removal of a mountain that is standing where your temple of success should stand, but where it never can stand until you have removed the mountain. You may never have noticed the mountain to which I refer, but it is standing there in your way just the same, unless you have already discovered and removed it. And what is this mountain, you ask? It is the feeling that you have been cheated unless you receive material pay for all the service you render. That feeling may be unconsciously expressing itself and destroying the very foundation of your temple of success in scores of ways that you have not observed. In the very lowly bred type of humanity, this feeling usually seeks outward expression in terms something like this: "I am not paid to do this, and I'll be blankety blankety blank if I'll do it." You know the type of person to which reference is made. You have met with it many times, but you have never found a single person of this type who is successful, and you never will. Success must be attracted through understanding and application of laws which are as immutable as the laws of gravitation. It cannot be driven into the corner and captured as one would capture a wild steer. For this reason, you are requested to enter into the following experiment with the object of familiarizing yourself with one of the most important of these laws, namely the law of increasing returns. The experiment. During the next 6 months, make it your business to render useful service to at least one person every day, for which you neither expect nor accept monetary pay. Go at this experiment with faith that it will uncover for your use one of the most powerful laws that enter into the achievement of enduring success, and you will not be disappointed. The rendering of this service may take on any one or more of a score of forms. For example, it may be rendered personally to one or more specific persons, or it may be rendered to your employer in the nature of work that you perform after hours. Again, it may be rendered to entire strangers whom you never expect to see again. It matters not to whom you render this service, so long as you render it with willingness, and solely for the purpose of benefiting others. If you carry out this experiment in the proper attitude of mind, you will discover that which all others have been familiar with the law upon which it is based and discovered, namely that you can no more render service without receiving compensation than you can withhold the rendering of it without causing and suffering the loss of reward. Cause and effect, means and end, seed and fruit cannot be severed, says Emerson. For the effect already blooms in the cause, the end pre-exists in the means, the fruit in the seed. If you serve an ungrateful master, serve him the more. Put God in your debt. Every stroke shall be repaid. The longer the payment is withholden, the better for you, for compound interest on compound interest is the rate and usage of this exchanger. The law of nature is, do the thing, and you shall have the power. But they who do not the thing have not the power. Men suffer all their life long under the foolish superstition that they can be cheated. But it is as impossible for a man to be cheated by anyone but himself, as for as long to be and not to be at the same time. There is a third silent party to all our bargains. The nature and soul of things takes on itself the guarantee fulfillment of every contract, so that honest service cannot come to loss. Before you begin the experiment that you have been requested to undertake, read Emerson's essays on compensation, for it will go a very long way toward helping you to understand why you are making the experiment. Perhaps you have read Compensation before. Read it again. One of the strange phenomena that you will observe about this essay may be found in the fact that every time you read it, you will discover new truths that you did not notice during previous readings. A few years ago, I was invited to deliver the graduation address before the students of an Eastern college. During my address, I dwelt at length and with all the emphasis at my command on the importance of rendering more service and better service than that for which one is paid. After the address was delivered, the president and secretary of the college invited me to a luncheon. While we were eating, the secretary turned to the president and said, "I have just found out what this man is doing. He is putting himself ahead in the world by first helping others to get ahead." In that brief statement, he had epitomized the most important part of my philosophy on the subject of success. It is literally true that you can succeed best and quickest by helping others to succeed. Some 10 years ago, when I was engaged by an advertising agency, I built my entire clientele by the application of the fundamentals upon which this lesson is founded. By having my name placed on the follow-up list of various mail-order houses, I received their sales literature. When I received a sales letter or a booklet or a folder which I believed I could improve, I went right to work on it and made the improvement, then sent it back to the firm that had sent it to me, with a letter stating that this was but a trifling sample of what I could do, that there were plenty of other good ideas where the one came from, and that I would be glad to render regular service for a monthly fee. Invariably, this brought an order for my services. On one occasion, I remember that the firm was dishonest enough to appropriate my idea and use it without paying me for it, but this turned out to be an advantage to me in this way. A member of the firm who was familiar with the transaction started another business, and as a result of the work I had done for his former associates, for which I was not paid, he engaged me to serve him, on the basis that paid me more than double the amount I would have realized from his original firm. Thus the law of compensation gave back to me, and with compound interest added, that which I had lost by rendering service to those who were dishonest. If I were looking for a profitable field of employment today, I could find it by again putting into action this plan of rewriting sales literature as a means of creating a market for my service. Perhaps I would find others who would appropriate my ideas without paying me for them. But by and large, people would not do this for the simple reason that it would be more profitable for them to deal fairly with me and thereby avail themselves of my continued service. Several years ago, I was invited to deliver a lecture before the students of the Palmer School at Davenport, Iowa. My manager completed arrangements for me to accept the invitation under the regular terms, in effect at that time, which were $100 for the lecture and my traveling expenses. When I arrived at Davenport, I found a reception committee awaiting me at the depot, and that evening I was given one of the warmest welcomes I had ever received during my public career up to that time. I met many delightful people, from whom I gathered many valuable facts that were of benefit to me. Therefore, when I was asked to make out my expense account so the school could give me a check, I told them that I had received my pay many times over by that which I learned while I was there. I refused my fee and returned to my office in Chicago, feeling well repaid for the trip. The following morning, Dr. Palmer went before the 2,000 students of his school and announced what I had said about feeling repaid by what I had learned and added. In the 20 years that I had been conducting this school, I have had scores of speakers address the student body, but this is the first time I have ever known a man to refuse his fee because he felt that he had been repaid for his services in other ways. This man is the editor of a national magazine, and I advise every one of you to subscribe for that magazine, because such a man as this must have that much each of you will need when you go into the field and offer your services. By the middle of that week, I had received more than $6,000 for subscriptions to the magazine over which I was editor. And during the following 2 years, these same 2,000 students and their friends sent in more than $50,000 for subscriptions. Tell me, if you can, how or where I could have invested $100 as profitably as this, by refusing to accept my $100 fee, and thereby setting the law of increasing returns to work in my behalf. We go through two important periods in this life. One is that period during which we are gathering, classifying, and organizing knowledge, and the other is that period during which we are struggling for recognition. We must first learn something which requires more effort than most of us are willing to put into the job. But after we have learned much that can be of useful service to others, we are still confronted with the problem of convincing them that we can serve them. One of the most important reasons why we should always be not only ready but willing to render service is the fact that every time we do so, we gain thereby another opportunity to prove to someone that we have ability. We go just one more step toward gaining the necessary recognition that we must all have. Instead of saying to the world, "Show me the color of your money, and I will show you what I can do," reverse the rule and say, "Let me show you the color of my service, so that I may take a look at the color of your money, if you like my service." In 1917, a certain woman who was then nearing the 50-year-old milepost of life was working as a stenographer at $15 a week. Judging by the salary, she must have been none too competent in that work. Now note this change. Last year, this same woman cleared a little over $100,000 on the lecture platform. What bridged that mighty chasm between these two earning capacities, you ask, and I answer? The habit of performing more service and better service than that for which she was paid, thereby taking advantage of the law of increasing returns. This woman is well known throughout the country, as she is now a prominent lecturer on the subject of applied psychology. Let me show you how she harnessed this law of increasing returns. First, she goes into a city and delivers a series of 15 free lectures. all may attend who will, without money and without price. During the delivery of these 15 lectures, she has the opportunity of selling herself to her audience. And at the end of the series, she announces the formation of a class for which she charges $25 per student. That's all there is to her plan. Where she is commanding a small fortune for a year's work, there are scores of much more proficient lecturers who are barely getting enough from their work to pay their expenses, simply because they have not yet familiarized themselves with the fundamentals upon which this lesson is based, as she has done. Now, I would like to have you stop right here and answer this question. If a 50-year-old woman who has no extraordinary qualifications can harness the law of increasing returns and make it raise her from the position of a stenographer at $15 a week to that of a lecturer at over $100,000 a year, why can you not apply this same law so that it will give you advantages that you do not now possess? Never mind what is to come in the remainder of this lesson until you have answered this question and answer it as it should be answered. You are struggling, either meekly or earnestly, to make a place for yourself in the world. Perhaps you are exerting enough effort to bring you success of the highest order, if that effort were coupled with and supported by the law of increasing returns. For this reason, you owe it to yourself to find out just how you can apply this law to best advantage. Now go back to that question again, for I am determined that you shall not pass it by lightly, without giving yourself the benefit of at least trying to answer it. In other words, there is no mistaking the fact that you are being brought face to face with a question that vitally affects your future, and if you evade it, the fault will be with you. You may lay this lesson aside after you have read it, and it is your privilege to do so, without making any attempt to profit by it. But if you do so, you will never again be able to look at yourself in a mirror without being haunted by that feeling that you have deliberately cheated yourself. Perhaps this is the telling the truth in an undiplomatic way. But when you purchased this course on the law of success, you did so because you wanted facts, and you are getting them without the embellishment of apology. After you have finished this lesson, if you will go back and review the lessons on initiative and leadership and enthusiasm, you will better understand those lessons. Those lessons and this one clearly establish the necessity of taking the initiative, following it with aggressive action, and doing more than you are paid to do. If you will burn the fundamentals of these three lessons into your consciousness, you will be a changed person. And I make this statement regardless of who you are or what your calling may be. If this plain language has made you angry, I am glad, for it indicates that you can be moved. Now, if you would profit by the counsel of one who has made many more mistakes than you have ever made, and for that reason learned a few of the fundamental truths of life, harness this anger and focus it on yourself until it drives you forth to render the service of which you are capable. If you will do this, you can collect a king's ransom as your reward. Now, let us turn our attention to still another important feature of this habit of performing more service and better service than that for which we are paid. Namely, the fact that we can develop this habit without asking for permission to do so. Such service may be rendered through your own initiative, without the consent of any person. You do not have to consult those to whom you render the service, for it is a privilege over which you have entire control. There are many things you could do that would tend to promote your interests, but most of them require the cooperation or the consent of others. If you render less service than that for which you are paid, you must do so by leave of the purchaser of the service, or the market for your service will soon cease. I want you to get the full significance of this right of prerogative, which you have, to render more service and better service than that for which you are paid. For this place squarely upon your shoulders the responsibility of rendering such service, and if you fail to do so, you haven't a plausible excuse to offer an alibi upon which to fall back, if you fail in the achievement of your definite chief aim in life. One of the most essential, yet the hardest truth that I have had to learn is that every person should be his own hardest taskmaster. We are all fine builders of alibis and creators of excuses in support of our own shortcoming. We are not seeking facts and truths as they are, but as we wish them to be. We prefer honeyed words of flattery to those of cold, unbiased truth, wherein lies the weakest spot of the animal world. Furthermore, we are up in arms against those who dare to uncover the truth for our benefit. One of the most severe shocks I received in the early part of my public career was the knowledge that men are still being crucified for the high crime of telling the truth. I recall an experiment I had some 10 years ago with a man who had written a book advertising his business school. He submitted this book to me and paid me to review it and give him the candid opinion of it. I reviewed the book with painstaking care, then did my duty by showing him wherein I believed the book was weak. Here I learned a great lesson, for the man became so angry that he has never forgiven me for allowing to look at his book through my eyes. When he asked me to tell him frankly what criticism I had to offer of the book, what he really meant was that I should tell him what I saw in the book that I could compliment. That's human nature for you. We court flattery more than we do the truth. I know because I am human. All of which in preparation for the unkindness cut of all, that I am duty-bound to inflict upon you, namely to suggest that you have not done as well as you might have done, for the reason that you have not applied a sufficient amount of truth set out in Lesson 8 on self-control, to charge yourself with your own mistakes and shortcomings. To do this takes self-control and plenty of it. If you paid some person who had the ability and the courage to do it, $100 to strip you of your vanity and conceit and love for flattery, so that you might see the weakest part of your makeup, the price would be reasonable enough. We go through life stumbling and falling and struggling to our knees, and struggling and falling some more, making asses of ourselves, and going down finally in defeat, largely because we either neglect or flatly refuse to learn the truth about ourselves. Since I have come to discover some of my own weaknesses through my work of helping others discover theirs, I blush with shame when I take a retrospective view of life and think how ridiculous I must have seemed in the eyes of those who could see me as I wouldn't see myself. We parade before the enlarged shadows of our own vanity and imagine that those shadows are our real selves, while the few knowing souls with whom we meet stand in the background and look at us with pity or with scorn. Hold on a minute, and I am not through with you yet. You have paid me to delve into the depths of your real self and give you an introspective inventory of what is in there, and I am going to do the job right as nearly as I can. Not only have you been fooling yourself as to the real cause of your failures in the past, but you have tried to hang these causes on the door of someone else. When things did not go to suit you, instead of accepting full responsibility for the cause, you have said, "Oh, hang this job. I don't like it, the way they are treating me, so I am going to quit." Don't deny it. Now let me whisper a little secret in your ear, a secret which I have had to gather from grief and heartaches and unnecessary punishment of the hardest sort. Instead of quitting the job because there were obstacles to master and difficulties to be overcome, you should have faced the facts, and then you would have known that life itself is just one long series of mastery of difficulties and obstacles. The measure of a man may be taken very accurately by the extent to which he adapts himself to his environment and make it his business to accept responsibility for every adversity with which he meets, whether the adversity grows out of the cause within his control or not. Now if you feel that I have panned you rather severely, have pity on me, O fellow wayfarer, for you surely must know that I have had to punish myself more sorely than I have punished you before I learned the truth that I am here passing on to you for your use and guidance. I have a few enemies, and thank God for them, for they have been vulgar and merciless enough to say some things about me that forced me to rid myself of some of the most serious shortcomings, mainly those which I did not know I possessed. I have profited by the criticism of these enemies, with having to pay them for their services in dollars, although I have paid in other ways. However, it was not until some years ago that I caught sight of some of the most glaring faults which were brought to my attention as I studied Emerson's essay on compensation, particularly the following part of it. Our strength grows out of our weaknesses. Not until we are pricked and stung and sorely shot at, awakens the indignation which arms itself with secret forces. A great man is always willing to be little. While he sits on the cushion of advantage, he goes to sleep. When he is pushed, tormented, defeated, he has a chance to learn something. He has been put on his wits, on his manhood. He has gained facts, learned his ignorance, is cured of the insanity of conceit, has got moderation and real skill. The wise man always throws himself on the side of his assailants. It is more his interest than it is theirs to find his weak point. Blame is safer than praise. I hate to be defended in a newspaper. As long as all that is said against me, I feel a certain assurance of success. But as soon as honeyed words of praise are spoken of me, I feel as one that lies unprotected before his enemies. Study this, the philosophy of the immortal Emerson, for it may serve you as a modifying force that will temper your mental and prepare you for the battles of life, as carbon tempers the steel. If you are a very young person, you need to study it all the more, for it often requires the stern realities of many years of experience to prepare one to assimilate and apply this philosophy. Better that you should understand these great truths as a result of my undiplomatic presentation of them than to be forced to gather them from the less sympathetic sources of cold experience. Experience is a teacher that knows no favorites. When I permit you to profit by this truth, I have gathered from the teaching of this cold and unsympathetic teacher called experience. I am doing my best to show you favoritism, which reminds me somewhat of the times when my friends used to do his duty by me in the woodshed, always starting with this bit of encouraging philosophy. Son, this hurts me worse than it does you. Thus we approach the close of this lesson without having exhausted the possibility of the subject, nay, without having more than scratched the surface of it. There comes to my mind the story of a romance of long ago, through which I can leave in your mind the main import of this lesson. This story has its setting in the city of Antioch, in ancient Rome, 2,000 years ago, when the great city of Jerusalem and all the land of Judea were under the oppressive heel of Rome. The star figure of the story was a young Jew by the name of Ben-Hur, who was falsely accused of crime and sentenced to hard labor at the galley's oar. Chained to a bench in the galley and being forced to tug wearily at the oars, Ben-Hur developed a powerful body. Little did his tormentors know that out of this punishment would grow the strength with which he would one day gain his freedom. Perhaps Ben-Hur himself had no such hopes. Then came the day of the chariot races, the day that was destined to break the chains that bound Ben-Hur to the oars of the galley and gave him his freedom. One span of horses was without a driver. In desperation, the owner sought the aid of the young man's slave because of his mighty arms and begged him to take the place of the missing driver. As Ben-Hur picked up the reins, a mighty cry went out from the onlooker. "Look, look, those arms! Where did you get them?" they howled, and Ben-Hur answered, "At the galley's oars." The race was on. With those mighty arms, Ben-Hur calmly drove the charging span of horses on to victory, victory that won for him his freedom. Life itself is a great chariot race, and the victory goes only to those who have developed the strength of character and determination and willpower to win. What matters is that we develop this strength through cruel confinement at the galley's oar, as long as we use it so that it brings us finally to victory and freedom. It is a unvarying law that strength grows out of resistance. If we pity the poor blacksmith who swings a 5-pound hammer all day long, we must also admire the wonderful arm that he develops in doing it. Because of the dual constitution of all things in labor as in life, there can be no cheating, says Emerson. The thief steals from himself. The swindler swindles himself. For the real price of labor is knowledge and virtue, wherein wealth and credit are signs. The signs, like paper money, may be counterfeited or stolen, but that which they represent, namely knowledge and virtue, cannot be counterfeited or stolen. Henry Ford receives 15,000 letters a week from people who are begging for a part of his wealth. Yet how few of these poor ignorant souls understand that Ford's real wealth is not measured by the dollars he has in his bank, nor the factory he owns, but by the reputation he has gained through the rendering of useful service at a reasonable price. And how did he gain that reputation? Certainly not by rendering as little service as possible and collecting for it all he could filch from the purchasers. The very warp and woof of Ford's business philosophy is this: give the people the best product at the lowest price possible.